what would you say is the biggest secret coming out of the Civil War that you never hear about in history books?
Okay.
Makes a big difference in terms of what we see as the future of America back then that becomes the 20th century.
The biggest secret is that alleged statement by Chancellor Bismarck.
Right.
That the financial powers of Europe had determined to kill Mr. Lincoln. Now, I spent a lot of time in the second book, and we won't go into it here because I know you want to do another show on the second book.
Yes.
But briefly, there is no solid primary source for Bismarck's statement. Hmm. Okay. So you have to.
You think he made it?
Oh, I do absolutely think he made it. Yes. You have to argue contextually as to what the biggest secret is. What is Bismarck alluding to? You know, this is a guide that you have to read between the lines every time he opens his mouth. What I point out in the second book is that President Grant, who by any honest estimation had to have been one of the most corrupt presidents in all of American history. Okay.
Wow, yeah.
No two ways about it. All right. President Grant, after he left office after his second term, went on a round the world tour. Took 2 years to circumnavigate the world. While he's in Europe, he stopped off to see his old friend Otto von Bismarck. Okay? Now, you got to picture this. Ulysses S. Grant and Otto von Bismarck smoking cigars and having tea are probably not talking about their grandkids and their pictures.
Oh, yeah.
Okay? Not a chance. So what I think this meeting was, let's go back to Walter Bosley's NIMSA hypothesis with respect to the airship mysteries.
Yes.
Bosley posits that NIMSA, which appears on those very weird paintings of Charles Delshow, that NIMSA is actually an acronym with the Y replacing the J of a German. So in German, it would be NMZYA, which he believes stands for National Jagdflugzeug Zahlungsamt, okay, which in German is the National Aircraft Payment Office.
Right.
In other words, it's the funding mechanism for airship research.
Right. Yes.
Okay. And obviously, it's German.
Yeah. The German part doing that opens it up dramatically immediately.
Oh, very dramatically. Because during the war between the states, and you have to go into the second book to see this, but during the war between the states, the Comstock lode that I mentioned earlier is actually being explored by a German geologist. Want to know what his name was?
All right.
Freiherr von Richthofen.
Right.
Now, von Richthofen, as most people know, is the surname of the family of the Red Baron of World War One fighter pilot fame. Okay,
yes.
So in other words, this is a very highly placed German noble family, and one of them's over here scratching around in the dirt in Nevada talking about the Comstock lode.
Wow.
The other, to me, the thing that really says there's something going on at the end of the war between the states, and Abe Lincoln and Jeff Davis know all about it, and they ain't talking.
Wow. Yeah.
And that is, there's a picture in the second book of Colonel Ulrich Dahlgren, the Union colonel that led that 1864 raid against Richmond. The raid was for the ostensible purpose of capturing and killing President Davis and his cabinet. Okay.
Yeah.
It's a little known episode of the Civil War. And needless to say, the Confederates returned the favor by raiding Washington, D.C. So,
you know, yeah, right.
Tit for tat. But anyway, there is a picture in the second book of Colonel Dahlgren standing with a couple of other Union officers that are sitting kind of on the ground. But seated in front of Colonel Dahlgren, right in the center of this photograph, is Count Graf von Zeppelin.
Oh, Zeppelin. Here we go.
There you go.
The great Zeppelin airship.
The great Zeppelin airships. Now, what is a Prussian colonel who's going to invent these dirigibles? What is he doing seated with Colonel Dahlgren and his officers?
Wow.
Why is he even over here?
Yeah.
There's not any explanation anywhere for that picture. In fact, the book that I got the picture from didn't even mention, didn't even go to any potential significance of what that picture may have represented.
Huh.
And to me, it's nuts, because that kind of picture begs for some sort of explanation. We have a Union colonel that was in charge of a covert operation, a decapitation operation against the Confederate government, sitting with a Prussian nobleman who is the inventor of dirigibles during the war. What are they doing?
Wow.
So my speculation is, Ulysses S. Grant inherits this airship project from Lincoln and from Andrew Johnson. And upon his conclusion in office, one of the first places he heads to is Berlin to meet with Otto. And I suspect that the subject of discussion was, well, I'm bringing you up to date on where things are.
Oh, yeah.
I really, these are not two gentlemen that are going to discuss their grandkids and their pictures.
Right. Well, it's amazing, because if you jump in that era to all those reports that you're talking about, mm-hmm. about airships, there are witness testimonies about who comes out. And inevitably, those people are connected with the Cosmos Club.
Yes. And by the way, they're human.
Yes.
And by the way, they converse.
Right, right.
So, you know, this is not E.T.
Mm-hmm.
And these contraptions, whatever they're flying, you know, what are you going to call them with the language of the day? Well, airship, they're a craft of some sort. You can guide and steer them around. They have to stop for supplies every now and then. So, yeah, I definitely think that there is a Civil War connection here that we have not yet plumbed. That connection comes from President Lincoln and his funding of this project. And I suspect that Edwin Stanton, being Edwin Stanton, decided not to support the project, not because he didn't want to pursue the technology. He just did not want to pursue it in quite the public manner that Abraham Lincoln and his Congress wanted to pursue it.
Right. Let's talk underground development.
Bingo.
Yeah.
And well, somehow it ends up in Texas, and Jeff Davis just happens to be headed there.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Tell me another one.
It is interesting that some of those reports of the airships, if you read them, at times people think, oh, they're telling us that we're going to war with Cuba.
Yes.
And I always thought that was very unusual, that this is a new weapon for against Cuba somehow. Yeah,
which we eventually went to war with.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So there are hints there. There's echoes, even that Cuba comes up at all around the airship piece. But if you had to look at the connection of Dalzell in that early period with that group that's over there in Sonora, they're another piece of that development. It is maybe a scientific core piece over there, which this German group is trying to exploit for war purposes.
It could be. It could be that. It could be. It could be that the Airship Club is being channeled a bunch of science from Germany, from the funding and so on. In other words, there's this very strange loop. And what I personally suspect is you have some sort of international effort going on here. That's why it's so secret, because you can't at that period of time, you can't engage internationally in a project like that without running afoul of treason laws in different countries. So you're going to keep it very, very secret. And there's another aspect of this, I think, that people forget, you know, that I think is significant with respect to the Airship mystery ending up in Texas. And, you know, Jeff Davis trying to get to that particular place to continue the war. Why is Davis so significant here? Because during the administration of President Franklin Pierce, who was the Secretary of War? Jefferson Davis.
Oh, that's where he came out of. Right.
Right. So there's nothing going on in Lincoln's War Department, particularly with the Confederate Espionage Service, that Davis probably wasn't perfectly well aware of long before. And by the way, when he was Secretary of War, that's when the Airship mystery gets started. So do you think someone like Jeff Davis is going to ignore the development of a technology like that? Not a chance.
Right.
Not a chance.
There's just too many stories of it. Yeah. I mean, Keeley's story.
Yes.
About how he demonstrated a craft that could go 500 miles an hour?
Yes, yes.
I mean, for the U.S. Army then.
Right.
1878.
Yeah, I think.
So, you know, a decade or so after the Civil War. There it is again.
Right.
Here's a flying ship. The rates of speed are off the charts, you know.
Yep.
Once you get the Wright brothers, it's basically a bicycle with wings, right?
Yeah. It's actually, if you compare the Wright brothers, like you say, if you compare the Wright brothers to what's being recorded for the airships, the Wright brothers are actually a step backward in terms of performance capability.
Yes.
It makes you wonder, because it's almost as if you can take the whole idea, you know, that I was pursuing in the Nazi books of a public space program and a secret space program. You can take that whole template and shove it back into the 19th century and see
the nucleus.
There's the nucleus of it.
And by the time you're into World War II and the 50s and the Kennedy years, then you're an expanded world. You have blown up with the currencies, you've blown up with the wars, you've blown up with the resources and the population. But here's the same core argument, which is you have a president who's assassinated, who's dealing with exotic technology, and he's publishing his own money.
Yep, exactly.
It is so an amazing correlation.
Yeah, it is an amazing correlation, and this is the problem, because what it means is if Bosley's correct, and I think he is, that you have this infrastructure being developed in the 19th century, then from the end of the Civil War, 1865, to the assassination of John F. Kennedy in 1963, that's 98 years. Mm-hmm. So you've had almost an entire century of development.
Right.
If this project continued up until Kennedy, and you know, all the indications are that something along these lines is being researched, at least in this country and Germany during that time period, for about 100 years.
Incredible.
That's incredible.
Now that's the arc of time that would take you, so that when you're looking at normal things like planes, and the things that they had available in the 40s and 50s versus flying saucers, UFOs, and all the rest of it. That's the arc that would at least give you some idea that there could be something else. I go back to John Warner IV, who came on this program and said, you know, that Paul Mellon told him after a couple of martinis that when he went over to Germany right after the war and they put him in Peenemünde, and he was standing on a craft, and the craft was a football field and a half in diameter. There's no correlation. There's no step correlation for that in history without years of development. Yeah. Right.
Exactly. And what I hope people are latching onto here is this development is not the reverse crash engineer story that, as you indicated earlier, gets overused. You know, my problem with that as an explanation is it's a go nowhere explanation, because what it prevents you from looking at are the human technological, scientific, and engineering papers and ideas that lead up to these technologies. Well, clearly somebody is thinking along these lines as the world is beginning to industrialize. Well, why can't we fly? We better investigate that now too.
Yeah.
So, exactly. This gives you an antecedent for it.
But you get an opening, and the Roswell case is so fascinating for this reason, which is you get an opening into something that happens with this advanced tech.
Yes.
Outside of the realm, you know, finally it hits into the public that there's this something else.
There's just something else.
Yeah. And whether it's alien or whether it's advanced technology out of these programs, it's different. It's no question. And so that secret system somehow has to deal with the burden.
Has to deal with it.
Yeah. A number of people hearing about this, seeing it, families involved, and all the rest, public officials involved. You know, there's a governor involved. In the Roswell case, the Roswell one, I think, still has many things to tell us.
Oh, absolutely, I do. Yeah. I agree with that. My principal disagreement with the Roswell narrative is that I personally see no good evidence for a crashed extraterrestrial craft. I think there are better candidates for that than Roswell. I think Cape Girardeau in Missouri is one of them, because there's a real cover-up going on there that is much tighter than anything around Roswell. Mm-hmm. I have never found, in fact, I get downright irritated with people that say, well, all that German stuff came from a crashed and recovered UFO. The problem with that story is it's a story for which there is very, very little prima facie primary evidence. So I'm not against the idea of crash and retrieval, but I think your first duty methodologically is to explore and exhaust any potential speculative human reconstruction of a technology tree before you go there. If you can't do that, then if you're leaping to the crash and retrieval explanation, you're ending up with no explanation. So just like your friend Warner standing on top of a thing as big as a football field or as wide as a football field. Well, where's the antecedent?
Yeah.
You know, with this idea of a 19th century prototypical development of not just the technology, but of the funding infrastructure needed to sustain a project like that, you've got a real antecedent to something that in 100 years or less could lead to something like that. This is my problem with the crash and retrieval narrative. Always has been.
Well, yeah, especially if it's exclusive to that.
That's my problem. You know, I don't think that you can explain every UFO incident or event by human technology or black projects. I don't think that. You know, as I mentioned, I think the Cape Girardeau case is a much stronger case for an actual crash of something.
And very, recovery. Very strange.
It's a very, very strange case.
With good old Senator Harry Truman at the helm.
Harry Truman at the helm, right.
Yeah. I'm curious about this. Mm-hmm. So there's a case a year later, the Aztec case, Aztec New Mexico. Yes. A lot of good witnesses again. Very unusual. This time the craft lands and it's basically intact. There's just little problems with it. And again, you have bodies. You have all these different things in the Aztec case. Here's the interesting thing that I thought came out of it, which is that whole thing about Silas Newton, this scientist who's a millionaire who wants to get into this case, and how the FBI try to discredit it immediately and say, oh, they're hucksters who are selling oil leases and other nonsense like that. But the interesting thing about Newton, good old J. Edgar. Newton, they picked up the name for the man who fell to Earth also, which is filmed in Roswell before anyone even knew there was a crash there. I mean, it had been suppressed in 47, the movies in 75. That's kind of weird.
I know the movie you're talking about.
Yeah, Mr. Newton, yeah.
Yeah.
But here's what I heard when I was looking at it, what Silas Newton gave in a speech that got him in so much trouble right afterwards. He said, I've been working in a situation redeveloping this craft and talking to the scientists who worked on it. And they said that the government discovered that they could only have the scientists work in there 15 to 20 minutes at a time or else they would fall ill. That was one. So if they went inside the craft and they were doing something in there for research, forget it. 15, 20 minutes was max. But then the second part was very strange, which reminded me of something that you had said about the astronauts, which was that they would go in and they would see relatives who had passed away. They start to enter into this kind of interdimensional phase. And we heard this about the NASA astronauts when they hit the moon, that they would see these loved ones who had passed on. What do you think is happening there when you get around this kind of what I call apotheum effect that seems to come out of these unusual things?
I don't know. To me, it's very, very strange that you have so many stories like this that are similar. And off the top of my head, my speculation would be along two lines. The first would be that somehow this is connected to that old idea that you have from the Slavonic text of Enoch, that the moon, the orbit of the moon, is the boundary for that quarantine zone around the Earth. And in the Slavonic text of Enoch, you have very clearly stated the idea that this is where the souls of the departed go after they die. It's in that region. So in other words, it's right here in local space that you're going to encounter your loved ones or, you know, distant family ancestors, whatever, right here in this area of local space at the boundary of the moon. So I think that might be a part of it. You know, and how did whoever wrote the Slavonic text of Enoch find that out? You know, but leaving aside that little difficulty, the other thing that I think is very interesting is I'm a firm believer, as you know, that the mind and the brain are not the same thing. And in a certain sense, I also do not believe that our souls are imprisoned in our bodies. I'm not a Gnostic, folks. I rather think that our bodies exist inside of our souls, that our brain exists inside of our mind. Because there's been a recent series of articles of people involved in the neurosciences, and I find these fascinating, that are suggesting that the brain is storing memories by accessing hyperdimensionality. In other words, our memories are not even located inside the three-dimensional space of our skull. They're not in our brain, but rather they're in some sort of hyperdimensional space that our brain is connected to. Now, the reason that makes a lot of sense to me, and I suspect, incidentally, that this is true not just of human brains, but, you know, of the higher animals, because clearly animals have some sort of intelligence and memory, and they clearly can oftentimes see things that we can't, you know, in weird ways. You know, this, my little dog freaks me out half the time because she's barking at things that aren't there. But anyway, I suspect that memory is an aspect of this hyperdimensional aspect of electromagnetism. I go back to Gabriel Krohn, the famous Hungarian electrical engineer, ended up at General Electric in Schenectady. Crone is a fascinating, brilliant man because he taught his electrical engineers tensor calculus and to use the tensor calculus as a way of finding out how to build any type of electrical circuit that you can imagine. And this is a brilliant step because tensor calculus is, you know, at that time was only really being used by general relativity and people like Einstein. You couldn't do anything practical with it. Mm-hmm. But Crone realized that the tensor calculus gave you the ability to create the generalized equations of electromagnetism and then manipulate them for the precise purpose of designing a machine that would do specific things like a UFO. And so he comes up with the idea that all electrical circuits, because they must be modeled with imaginary numbers, that's the key. All electrical circuits, no matter how simple they are always hyperdimensional in nature. They inhabit a world that is more than just three dimensions.
Interesting.
So, you know, take all those signals firing in our brains. Well, what he's really saying is that organ exists not only inside your skull, but in some way it exists in a hyperdimensional space that's completely outside these three dimensions. Because, again, an imaginary number, if you graph it, an imaginary number is graphed mathematically, conceived mathematically, as an axis, AXIS, that is perpendicular to the other three axes of length, width, and depth. That's exactly how you do hyperdimensional mathematics. You just pile on perpendicular axes.
It's almost like drawing coordinates in remote viewing. So somebody can go there. As soon as you direct the consciousness to go there, bang, you're there.
Bang, it goes there. Bang, yes. So we're our intelligence, our memory, our even our emotional life, I would suggest, is existing in this non-material hyperdimensional world of some sort, and that world in turn can be modeled with mathematical precision. So I think seeing relatives in a situation like that, where you are in an electromagnetically rich environment, like between the Earth and the Moon, it makes a lot of sense to me, to be quite honest with you. And I think we have to get over our fear of speculating about such things or thinking, oh, it's just all occult and satanic and evil. You know, how dare you think about stuff like that? You know?
The minute you bring in the paranormal, it's evil. You know it.
Oh, it's evil. Yes. Well, I think, yeah, exercise some due caution.
Yeah. Careful with the AI Ouija board, right?
Yeah, careful with the AI Ouija board. Yeah,
probably. Have you heard about the spirit box thing that they're doing?
I haven't heard, but I can imagine. just your phrase connecting Ouija boards with AI.
It's this enough. Thing. Yeah. I mean, this. Yeah. Spirit box is like a seance box online that you tap questions into and it gives you responses from those entities out there, you know.
Oh, how wonderful.
Well, that's AI. You know, I'm sure AI is generating it somewhere.
Okay, so they're admitting it and marketing it now. Okay. Yeah, right. All right. <gotcha. laughs> The fulfillment what happens is the when, deception. You know,
one of these days, Kukul Khan is just going to come out and be like, hey, download my software app. I'm back, baby.
It's the call of Cthulhu. You thought Lovecraft was just joking, weren't you?
So just try to segment out of that whole part. Yes.
Take that list, segue into the next segment from there.
I need to talk with you about General Walker, sir.
Okay, yes, I'm sorry.
Speaking of strange, highly strange.
Yeah.
General Walker one of the reasons predominantly we know about General Walker is he is the guy in the early 1960s who's pegged as that revolutionary general who doesn't agree with the way that politics are going and is more of a, kind of in that John Birch Society way of, you know, the nation state has betrayed us and we need to go back to core principles. And his entire pitch at certain times, at certain point when he's in West Germany talking to cadets, he gets into trouble for repeating this. And actually, Bobby Kennedy has him thrown in prison for a very short couple of weeks to kind of wise him up a little bit. But nonetheless, he's this extraordinary figure, agitator in that period. And he draws a lot of attention, including running for governor in 1962 and giving Connally, incredibly well-financed, a pretty good run for his money. Mm-hmm. So he's there. He's bouncing a lot between Texas and Germany. Mm-hmm. And what we know famously is that after the Kennedy assassination and after they laid all the blame on the designated culprit of Oswald, they came out with this thing of saying, hey, look, we have all this information that Oswald also shot at General Walker back in April of 1963. And, you know, this shows what a psycho that he was. He just wanted to take out some famous person. Now, interestingly enough, Walker himself never felt that Oswald was involved in trying to shoot at him. Of course, it's a failed assassination attempt. They even pull the bullet out of the wall and it has nothing to do with Oswald's rifle. But nonetheless, it sticks as, like, you know, supposed to be the Rosetta Stone of this psycho Oswald. Now, Walker, very interestingly, in 1975, writes to the Church Committee, who's investigating the CIA aspect involvement in the Kennedy assassination. And he says, and this is some of the new documentation that's come out. And he says, well, you know what, April 10th, when I was shot at, I never thought it was a lone gunman. I never thought it was Oswald. And there were two people. That's what the police told me. Mm-hmm. Now, then he goes on to say, later, someone high up in the Dallas Police Department got in touch with me that night and said, of April 10th, and said, we have Oswald, Lee Harvey Oswald, in custody. And also that a little later, he got released by somebody higher up in that structure, beyond the Dallas Police Department. Now, here's what's interesting. I was reading this one, Mae Brossel's book.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Fascism in America. And she has a section in there on Walker. And what she says is that on November 23rd, that he telephones this newspaper where he's connected over in Germany, and that newspaper was connected, yes, to the Reich in the background. And he tells them, hey, I was told that they had Oswald in custody back on April 10th and that he was released. He tells the same story back there originally, and then he comes out with it to the Church Committee later. Now, the implications of that, I think, are pretty dramatic. In any case, he says, I believe the CIA were the ones who were doing this, and they blamed Oswald. So he never bought into it. But the significance is that they grabbed Oswald early on for this. This is the implication from Walker. And that he was released by higher-ups because let him go.
That's so creepy.
Yeah. Now, that gives us a different picture of Walker. And the only other thing I want to say is that he's being run by Liberty Lobby, mm-hmm, as a presidential candidate. And the person that they are also running for president is FDR's former son-in-law.
Oh, my word.
Yeah.
That's an unlikely combination.
It is an unlikely combination. And what's interesting is the theme that draws them all together is this group of the Shinny Knights.
Yep.
And what I found out, and the part that fascinates me so much about this, it's in Scott's work, it's in other places, but Corso, Philip Corso, it's right in Dick Russell's book that he is a member of the Shinny Knights.
Yeah. Right. Yes.
So there's the Liberty Lobby, Shikshini Knights. Somehow that group connected around all of this. So how does it strike? I mean, I think we have new material there about Walker and Oswald. That's one. But two, yes. Just Walker's presence with these people. And I'll tell you another weird thing, since we mentioned Warner earlier. He told me that he knew that his cousin, Chris Mellon, who's been driving this UFO threat posture, and he's the DOD billionaire, he said he was a member.
Oh, wow.
His cousin. So, you know, I know that's a lot to throw at you in one question, but I guess what I'd be trying to get from you is your own estimation of Walker and some of those things we put on the record.
I'll tell you what I'm very suspicious of Walker, and I always have been, particularly now that you mentioned this connection with the Shikshani Knights. As you know, I have maintained for quite a few years that I find it horribly interesting that Lee Harvey Oswald, among the languages he was reputed or overheard as having spoken, was not just Russian, but German. And no one, to my knowledge, in the Kennedy research community draws attention to that. I do, because the reason I think this is significant is that the only people with boots on the ground inside the Soviet Union that could get him into the Soviet Union, hitched up with a daughter that's the colonel of a GRU colonel, and then get them both back out of the Soviet Union, was the old Galen network, Reinhard Galen's BND, the German network.
Incredible. Inside. Yes. And that would access that they had worldwide.
And that would explain Oswald's German. You know, why is he picking up German? You know, why would he need that? Well, yes, he would need it under those circumstances.
Well, his landlady heard him talking in German.
Landlady heard him talking in German. So that's the first problem. Then you have Walker. And I have not one shred of evidence here for what I'm about to suggest. But I've been suspicious of this German connection of his all along, particularly that I have that Mae Brussel book. And when the moment you showed it to me, I remembered that episode that she recounts in the book of him writing this for the paper. I suspect that Walker, just given his rank and his position in the military in that country at that time, would have inevitably have put him into contact with people in those types of circles, like General Galen. And with Walker being back and forth between Germany and Texas, this is the other thing that I'm trying to get at here. We know from Professor Scott's research that the Hunts and the Murchisons' intelligence sources were precisely General Galen's network. Mm-hmm. We have no liaison between the two. There's no known connection.
Right.
I suspect it's General Walker.
Oh, interesting.
That's my suspicion. So it would make sense then that if he is in that network, he knows something about Oswald and would therefore perhaps know that Oswald has a CIA connection in order for him to make the statements he subsequently does to the church committee.
Oh, right.
So that's my speculation with General Walker. He to me, Daniel, he has always had the same feel about him as Andreas Strassmeyer, the guy that was connected to the Oklahoma, Andy the German.
Yeah. Because you do a whole section in it's the Nazi book.
It's Nazi International that Nazi Andreas Strassmeyer is in.
That's amazing because he's connected to the Oklahoma City bombing and he's connected to the prime minister of Germany.
Andreas Strassmeyer is He's still alive. He's one of the most mystifying figures in the Oklahoma City bombing. And to this day, I don't think that people have given him enough attention nor been willing to follow all the leads, because
he's Andy the German.
He's Andy the German. He was the so-called chief of security at that white militant Aryan Christian group that was in Elohim City, Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, about 8 miles drive across the state line from Fort Smith. So, you know, I know that area very well. He was supposedly the head of security there. He was seen at a Tulsa strip joint with Tim McVeigh and probably Michael Fortier on numerous occasions. He was apprehended shortly before the bombing, barreling down Interstate 40, going west to east toward Fort Smith. He was pulled over by a state trooper for not having a license on his car, just like McVeigh. When he was pulled over, he was carrying a briefcase, apparently with a lot of important papers inside of them. He was hauled off for not having a license and speeding by the local deputy. And while he's in jail, the deputy gets calls from Governor Keating of Oklahoma telling that you had to release this guy. He's got diplomatic immunity. He got then another call from some lieutenant general in the Pentagon saying, you've got to release this guy. He's got diplomatic immunity. So finally, the deputy releases Strassmeyer. Then the next thing we know, the FBI, after the bombing occurs, the FBI is putting out a bolo because on Strassmeyer, because some people, and it is true, if you look at the pictures, the police drawings of John Doe number 2, they do bear a slight resemblance to Andreas Strassmeyer at that time. Well, as the FBI is combing the country for Strassmeyer, we learn that he pops back up in Berlin at his father's home, where he gives a press conference. We learn that he was, and here the stories differ, that he was helped out of the country by the CIA, or that he was actually helped out of the country by agents of the FBI, which is looking for him, or, and this is the one I think probably is true and has the most juice, he was smuggled out of the country by the German GSG-9. They're equivalent to the Navy SEALs or the Delta Force.
Wow. Incredible.
Yeah. And at the personal direction of Chancellor Kohl. Now, why do I think that that's possible? Because Andreas Strassmeyer's father is Helmut Kohl's minister without portfolio, a member of the federal cabinet in Germany, and the very man responsible for Kohl's reunification plan.
Oh, wow.
And Andy the German is a captain who graduated from the Hanover War Academy, their West Point, as a captain in the Panzer Grenadiers. So we have a German military officer in this country, wow, pretending to be a Civil War reenactor, who is the son of a German cabinet member smuggled out of the country by somebody's intelligence agency, who's chief of security for Elohim City, a right-wing whatever it is, seen in the company of Timothy McVeigh on several occasions. And I left out the fact that his lawyer was the then infamous Kirk Lyons, who was a lawyer notorious for defending all sorts of right-wing neo-Nazi Christian militia, you know, white supremacy groups. So make of him what you will, but he has that same gritty, oily feel that General Walker has all over him. Yeah.
And he's getting McVeigh into position to be this designated culprit.
he's doing something. I've never written a book on the Oklahoma City bombing, but I've researched it rather thoroughly. The thing about Strassmeyer is that there are people, there are witnesses that place him at the Mura building in the basement of the Mura building.
Okay.
As part of a maintenance crew that may have been putting detonator cord up on the pillars of that building. Now, I find that very significant because this is the sort of thing that a graduate of the Hanover War Academy and a captain in the German Army, especially the Panzer Grenadiers, would know how to do. Okay. And number two, if you look at the damage that was done to the Mura building, just do the math, run the math on the 4,500-pound ANFO bomb that they say brought that thing down, which is a bunch of nonsense, because that is a cantilevered, reinforced steel column building. And you see, when you see the pictures of the building, you'll notice that there's a column that is not the front columns, but it's a further row back. There's a column that is collapsed in the second row of columns from the Ryder truck.
Right.
That column shows two things when you look at the pictures. You can see a little rebar sticking out of the top of it that's been severed. And then the rest of the column is, you know, the spalling around it has just been shattered. It's blasted away. You cannot get that kind of fracture of steel rebar from an ANFO bomb two column rows into the building. There's not enough brisance or force from the explosion to do that. You can only get that by a detonation on the column itself.
What do you think? Why do you think they were taking out the Mura building? And why were they doing it at that point?
There has been all sorts of speculation about that. What some have alleged is that the records for the ATF and FBI raid on Waco were kept there. That is highly possible, in my opinion, because the man who was in charge of Waco after the FBI took over, Don Ricks, was based in Oklahoma City at that building.
Mm.
So you have that connection. There are allegations that much of the documentation that the Department of Justice was assembling on the Clintons, vis-a-vis MENA and Whitewater and all of that, was being kept in that building.
Ah.
And of course, once you've said MENA and Whitewater, you've said Bush family. You know, you've got that connection. That's another explanation. I've even read explanations that the Japanese, I forget the name of the cult in Japan, that had some sort of terrorist connection and was part of the ATF's concern at that time, was part of their records were in the building. And then you had April 19th itself, which was the second anniversary of the Waco massacre. You had the execution of a member of the this white Aryan Christian militia, whatever it was, that was executed in Arkansas on that day, on the day of the bombing. So there's all sorts of speculation as to what was going on there and what they were really after. I do think that they were after something. The most suspicious thing about the whole bombing is McVeigh's repeated claims to have been that he tried out for some sort of special forces duty and failed. Mm. There are people that think that the failure narrative was actually a narrative, that he was actually inducted. They've produced pictures purporting to show him after his discharge from the Army, participating in military exercises in North Dakota.
Oh, wow.
And the real whopper doozy that I've never seen anybody else that's researched the Oklahoma City bombing mention, and I heard this on a radio program, as a matter of fact, shortly after the bombing. There was a police detective in Tulsa, Oklahoma, by the name of Daniel Craig. Not Daniel Craig. Well, Craig is, I think it's Daniel Craig. I always get him confused with Roger Craig, the Dallas deputy. But this detective in Tulsa was contacted initially by Carol Howe, the ATF undercover agent at Elohim City that was trying to warn everybody that, hey, this German and this McVeigh guy are up to no good. You better stop him. He was contacted by her to do some research, and eventually he did a lot of research into the Oklahoma City bombing. And he published a book. I know I'm going around Harvey's barn, but this to me is the most...
Oh, yeah. Yes, please do.
This to me is the most extraordinary thing about the bombing that you never hear anybody talk about. He produced a book of his research after he got done of researching the Oklahoma City bombing called The Medusa File. He goes into the death of Sergeant Yeeky and, you know, all of this stuff. But he also points out that many of the people who traveled to Terre Haute, Indiana, one lady in particular, to witness McVeigh's execution, went on record after the execution as having seen McVeigh being taken out of the execution chamber, laid on a gurney, and, you know, put into an ambulance and hauled away for cremation. There's one lady in particular who maintains that after he was pronounced dead, she could still see him breathing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
It's that bad.
Oh.
It's that bad.
Wow.
I was in Tulsa, Oklahoma on that day. I was actually woken up by some friends who lived in the same apartment complex. They called me up and said, turn on your TV right now. And I said, what channel? I said, any channel, just turn it on. And they hung up. And I thought, what? You know. So I went and turned on my TV. And, of course, they were covering it. This was maybe half an hour, 45 minutes after the bombing had occurred. And
wow.
I was watching the local feed, both in Tulsa and Oklahoma City, and then changing the channel and watching the national feed. And I got to tell you, Daniel, it was two different things.
Oh, unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah. They already had a cover story ready.
They had a cover story ready. Yeah. There were several people that saw the bomb squad around the building before the bomb went off. Of course, the ATF and FBI didn't show up for work that day. They were seen on the ground very quickly after the bomb went off. There were people that heard more than one explosion. Of course, you've got the seismographic record from the University of Oklahoma, just, you know, a few miles south of Oklahoma City, that recorded two distinct events. The whole public narrative is of the same caliber and quality as the Warren Report.
Incredible. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, that entire story never seemed to resolve itself. And the idea of McVeigh, you know, acting on his own to do all that always seemed absurd.
Daniel, I knew when I was watching, you know, after I turned on the TV, I knew that the story was a gigantic lie almost immediately. You want to know how? As I was watching, I heard eventually they said, well, it was an ammonia nitrate ANFO bomb that exploded inside of a Ryder truck that was parked outside the front of the building. I knew immediately when they said that it was a lie. And the reason why I knew it was a lie is because one summer in college, I worked for my brother-in-law, who owned a concrete testing agency in Sioux Falls. And what concrete testing agencies do is they take samples of concrete pours at various buildings, and they subject that concrete to stress tests of various kinds to determine if that concrete is strong enough to bear any load. So my job was to take big cylinders, 6-inch wide cylinders, about 2-foot long concrete cylinders, and put them in a hydraulic press and turn the press on and make a note of when the concrete fractured and shattered, at what pressure. Daniel, I can tell you, you cannot, on just an ordinary concrete cylinder, not a rebar steel reinforced 2-foot wide column in a building, just a 6-foot concrete core, those things will only fracture at about 2,000 pounds per square inch.
Oh, wow.
And so when they said ANFO bomb on a concrete cantilevered building structure brought and created that mess, I thought,
it's fascinating, because when the year started, out with a bomb explosion in front of the Trump Hotel.
Yep.
And it was a Tesla. And the guy was a special forces guy, and he had this whole thing ready of his manifesto and all the rest. But one of the things I thought was very interesting is that he mentioned the UFO file. And I was like, Trump, Tesla, the UFO file, big explosion. Somebody, if they were orchestrating that, all the symbolism they were using, you got all four pillars there.
Yeah. Yeah. These things, I agree with you. These types of events are never planned without a heavy use of symbolism. Ever.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible. I had your quote that we'll wrap this up with, and then I'll have you comment on it. And it literally is, within 3 decades, Dr. Carol Rosen, former associate at Fairchild Industries of German rocket scientist and engineer Dr. Werner von Braun, would maintain that he told her of a long-term strategy involving just such a scenario. And I'll read it briefly just so everybody has this, because I notice it gets taken out of context a lot. This is the exact statement. The strategy that Werner von Braun taught me, this is what Carol Rosen says, was that the Russians are going to be considered the enemy. Then terrorists would be identified. And that was soon to follow. Then we were going to identify third world country crazies. We now call them nations of concern. But he said that would be the third enemy against whom we would build space-based weapons. The next enemy was asteroids. Now, at this point, he kind of chuckled the first time he said it. Asteroids, against asteroids, we are going to build space-based weapons. And the funniest one of them all was what he called aliens, extraterrestrial. And the upshot of that is, he says, but the upshot is that it's all going to be a lie. Mm-hmm. Now, that, Joseph, in the context of what you're talking about, what is von Braun giving her? He's saying, you know, he's at the end of his life and he's looking around and maybe thinking that he's been used by both systems at the end of the day. And he has some kind of conscience and he says, this is what they're going to do. They're going to create a space threat.
I think that reading of von Braun is probable, because I spoke with Dr. Rosen at the 2014 Space Program Conference precisely about these Nazi rocket scientists. And one of the things that she emphasized to me was that von Braun was part of a very small group of these Nazi scientists that had genuine problems and pangs of conscience.
Interesting.
And I can see that because of the von Braun family itself, when you dig into the family history of that family. You know, it's a noble family, and his brother was definitely not a supporter of the regime. His mother was a psychic, you know. So he comes from a very unusual family background for someone like that. But the other thing I think that lends a bit of credence to her recounting of that episode is, and I talk about this in my book, Covert Horrors, Saucers, Swastikas, and Psyops. And then in that book, I talk about how Colonel Skorzeny records in his diary that he saw a wonder weapon so fantastic that it opened up new vistas of psychological warfare for him. And I think he clearly is implying the idea that this exotic technology would be used to fake or stage some sort of external threat, like what von Braun is talking about. I think that's a possibility. That this is a narrative that's been long in preparation. The flip side of it is, you have von Braun himself pressing very diligently and ultimately being successful in getting Dr. Hermann Oberth to come to this country as part of Operation Paperclip. And if you read about Dr. Oberth, he's just a crazy guy. I mean, you know, he even looks crazy, but and kind of dour and sour. You know, he's just an incredible looking guy. But one of the things,
Hermann Oberth, right?
Yeah, Hermann Oberth, and he was asked, is when he finally arrived in this country at a press conference, some American reporter asked him, Dr. Oberth, how did you people manage to achieve all of these things that you did in such a short amount of time and under wartime conditions, no less? And his response, you know, and I can just see him very snooty and Prussian, you know, monocle inserted, saying, we had help, you know.
Wow.
And that's all he said. You know,
that's pretty big implication.
Okay, help from whom? You know, it wasn't the British, it wasn't the Russians.
I mean, it's disturbing. It is.
It's very disturbing. So, yeah. You know, what are we to take of it? Well, the way I always look at things like this is they're keeping the narrative open for the present. They haven't decided if we're going to fake it, stage it, or if it's genuine, if we're going to welcome it. They haven't made up their mind yet, because I don't think they've come to any firm conclusion as to what they're really dealing with. I mean, you know, it could be all sorts of things.
You've suggested that the danger is you stage the fake ET UFO threat and the real thing shows up.
Oh yeah, many times I can see it. I can, you know, I mean, I'm going on the C.S. Lewis idea that, you know, beware of calling down high heaven because it might show up. You know,
then you really got problems.
Yeah, then you've really got problems, especially if you've been doing so because you don't really think it exists. You know,
right.
And all of a sudden it shows up. What do you do? That can be a real game changer, and you know, it's throwing a slider in with your fastball. You know, just
we're in the season of UFO congressional hearings. They're coming up. They're rolling it out again. They tried the 3-Eye Atlas and all the rest. I'll tell you, the last thing I've got to have us ponder on is this: there was in that Cooper interview when they asked him. They said, do you think there is extraterrestrial life? Mm-hmm. And he said, I'm not so sure that there isn't extraterrestrial life on Mars if we were to explore those caverns more deeply. Now, what kind of a statement is that?
I can see it. One of the most interesting hypotheses that Richard Hoagland put out very, very early in his Mars investigations, especially during that period when he had a whole team involved with him that he had kind of assembled from Stanford and other places. One of the most interesting hypotheses that he put out is that these structures are so gigantic that they really kind of resemble arcologies. And he made reference to the Italian architect that designed these enormous buildings that would encompass whole cities. And he called them arcologies because they had to be very carefully designed and you know, to sustain a large population. I can see that happening because a civilization, if it were advanced enough and if it saw its impending doom clearly enough, would make such plans. It would be a continuity of government type of operation. So
right.
I don't have any problem with that hypothesis. And just to put a little Marvin the Martian twist to it, we had those strange cases of the Martian rover, about that little rover that we landed on the moon with a little tank transit that went around taking pictures of things, and all of a sudden it died. And NASA told us, well, it died because there was a dust storm, and the dust storm blew all sorts of dust on the solar panels, and that meant that it couldn't get energy to operate. And then about 6 months later, the thing starts up again. And assuming that NASA didn't turn it off deliberately and feed us a big story, which again is also possible, but assuming that it didn't, what accounts for the thing starting up? Because there wasn't another dust storm. And if there were winds strong enough to blow dust off of the solar panels, that would mean that the wind was also strong enough to blow more dust onto the solar panels.
Fascinating.
So how did the solar panels get clean?
So you're saying Cooper is tipping us off.
Yeah, I'm saying Cooper's tipping us off, because my explanation for that was Marvin the Martian came along with some Windex and some paper towels and cleaned the solar panels.
Wow.
So, yeah, here.
Joseph, absolutely incredible. And there's so much to explore in your recent book series dealing with the Civil War and how it relates to this.
Oh, yeah.
Exotic technology being built up in the background way back there, and yet we have that thread connecting it to the present day. Both of those books together, let me see the...
I would go further and say that if you want to understand the financial mess that they're talking about now, you have to read both books, particularly the second one, because the parallels are obvious in there.
The second one is the Rialto and Richmond Reconstructed.
Right.
And strangely enough, they fit in quite well with your breakaway books. And,
oh, yeah.
Absolutely fascinating. We will get back together again, because we're going to deal with some of these space subjects and also the very strange ripple thing.
Okay.
I demand, because people are demanding that we go deeper on that one, because they're so fascinated by the ripple discussion. And I guess the last thing I want to ask you is, since we brought up the airship mystery and all the rest of it, the fact that it's, and I put this in my documentary, but the big paintings where it says Trump and then 45, which is, Trump was the 45th president. What's fascinating is Delshow disappeared from history in 1920. Then all of his artworks showed up in an antique store. Somebody had come across this stuff. In 1971, an author realized the significance of the whole thing, and he started to bring out the images of the airships that were being developed in the 1850s. Now, here's where it all dovetails with the JFK assassination, and it's quite interesting. There's a character named John DeMille, and his wife's name was Dominique Schlumberger. She was a major artist and a major kind of humanitarian of the period and philanthropist. So she put the Delshow
art on display with all the arrows and all the rest of it. Well, in the Garrison investigation, he went into Schlumberger, or Schlumberger is the actual name in France. They were the biggest oil company, operating 75% of the oil equipment in the world. And he found out over and over again that they were related to characters like George de Bornschild, the oil geologist who shuttled Lee Harvey Oswald around. And it seemed kind of unusual. You know, here's Oswald making $1.25 an hour. And de Bornschild is a millionaire. What does he want to do with this guy? Well, it's quite interesting because de Bornschild is an oil geologist and later turns up writing letters to George Bush, who's the head of the CIA of the period, saying, you know, this Kennedy assassination thing happened. I talked out of turn about Oswald. Not all these people are after me. I wonder if you can get me off the hook. And he sends a series of letters to George Bush that are on the record from the 70s. This is like 10 years after the Kennedy assassination. So de Bornschild gets a subpoena, and they say, we're the House Assassination Committee. We think you have information about Oswald being connected to the CIA. He gets the subpoena, goes into his room, supposedly, and blows his brains out. Now, there's a lot of weird things about de Bornschild, including the fact that he was obviously assassinated himself because they had finally figured him out. But here's the strange part. The Delschau images came through Jean Dumanil and his wife, who were these incredible art connoisseurs. Those are the same people who had set up and were connected with de Bornschild. So the Schlumberger Oil Company and de Bornschild in Houston were, you know, operated on a very elite level, and they worked with people like the Bushes, etc. This is why he wrote letters to Bush as CIA director later. So you're looking at a dramatic crisscross, but in the middle of it, it can't be denied that Dumanil is the same person who put Delschau back on the map. Here's the Arrow Group again, back from the 1850s, NIMSA and the whole thing. And here's the thing. This is an arrow painting by Delschau. And it has two very interesting elements that are predictive. Remember earlier we looked at the Elon element that was predictive about von Braun's work. Mm-hmm. Well, when you look at this, what stands out for you is the name on the top. It says Trump.
Hard not to see.
On the bottom, on the right, it says 45, which is the art series. And Trump was the 45th president of the United States. Trump, 45, arrow, airship, all in one snap. That's Delschau's painting. Delschau has a series of works. He has over 500 paintings documenting the Sonora Aero Club. Apparently, Trump was on his radar 100 years earlier. Figure that one out.
I'm trying to.
So you can see we've come to a pretty deep place in the middle of all this. That's what happens when we get into the aerospace aero aspect of this. It shows up the crisscross politically, geopolitically, over and over again. Advanced technology, aerospace, and the political side. That is dark journalism.
What kind of symbology is that? Is that predictive? Are they giving us information? What do you think of it?
I assume you're referring to those Delschau pictures where it clearly shows paintings. Trump.
Yes.
Yeah, those are creepy. As is that whole novel about Baron Trump by John Lockwood or whatever his name is. I don't view them as predictive. I view them as we're looking at traces of early types of remote sensing experiments.
Oh, yeah.
Because we've got to remember that at that time period, particularly in this country, as well as in Europe, you had a lot of spiritualism going on. You had a lot of beginnings of what we would now call paranormal attempts to scientific attempts to document the paranormal began during this, all sorts of crazy stuff. Yeah. But at least the Victorian mind was trying to create a sufficiently scientific methodology for studying these phenomena. So you had that going on. I mean, after all, Abraham Lincoln was a spiritualist.
Yes.
You know, had seances in the White House. So this is the era. This is the milieu that these people were in. So I wouldn't be surprised that you have another aspect of this whole thing being experiments, secret experiments in that type of phenomenon, and that they saw or encountered something not necessarily predictive, but they saw it as something present and simply reported on it. That's my best take on it.
Interesting. So they are peering into a future with a connection.
Right.
And somehow the Trump name is involved with that technology.
Yeah. Now they're seeing some. Look, what are the odds that this happens entirely by coincidence or chance? Would you, Daniel List, be willing to lay actuarial tables on that and then wager any money on it?
It's off the charts.
Yeah, I'm not either. I'm with you. I ain't placing money on that bet. So yeah, there's something going on here, and we just don't know exactly what it is. That, you know, that's my best guess. You've got some sort of legacy or trace of some sort of experiment like that going on.
Well, I thought, here's the Delshow group, you know, predicting Trump, and here is von Braun predicting Elon and his Project Mars book.
Yeah.
So there's some Ouija board, a cosmic Ouija board in all of this.
Well, we know it is crystal clear that the Nazis did all sorts of experiments like, you know, the whole Ahnenerbedienst and Heinrich Himmler's obsession with the occult. You know, I just got done rereading my Thrice Great Hermetica book
and the
obsession of Otto Rahn, you know. Mm-hmm. So this milieu from 19th century spiritualism carries forward all the way up into the 20th century, especially inside of Germany. So I'm not a bit surprised. And wow. I suspect that there is some sort of hidden esoteric technology program. We know, in fact, that there is. Lynn Picknett and Clyde Prince did a whole book on it, you know, on Ingo Swann and the Nine and this whole quest of secret occult sources of information, the Stanford SRI remote viewing project and so on. So yeah, none of this would surprise me. And again, we just tend to think of all of this as a modern phenomenon. You know, well, it's going on in the 19th century, so why wouldn't they make it a part of their secret research?
Absolutely. It's the hand of the mystery schools intertwined with that political process. Very strange bedfellows.
And you know as well as I do that connection between that type of mystery school or occultism or esotericism, whatever you want to call it, and politics has been present, you know, for a very, very long time, particularly in Western culture. I mean, think of Queen Elizabeth I.
Yeah, right.
Doesn't get any clearer than that.
The John Dee piece, we're still catching up to whatever was going on there.
Well, John Dee, later on Francis Bacon.
Bacon.
You know, the whole Stuart monarchy is shot full of it. You have the whole Rosicrucian business shortly after the Reformation, and you know all of that that whole period. So it's nothing new. I mean, I don't see why people just get so upset about it. Why wouldn't these people make it a part of their secret research? Of course they would.
I always love the Gurdjieff quote, which is, the what to do is out there in the public, the how to do it stays hidden.
Yep. Very, very, very true.
Yes.
Very true. Wow.
We did a wonderful episode on Thrice Great Hermetica, and I'll tell you, that piece about Christopher Columbus, if people were to really apprehend it, wow. Yeah. It's a mind blower, but fantastic. Like all of your information and work, Joseph, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
The new book series is incredible. So we'll go deeper with the second book, and we'll also do the Ripple thing coming up, but
all right.
Off the charts, as always, sir.
All right. Thanks for having me back, Daniel.
Fantastic. I'm still processing the bearer bonds because, you know.
It is, to me, it's one of the most significant financial stories of maybe the last century and a half.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And no one seems to be wanting to talk about it. It's just been quietly shuffled aside. And
incredible. Yeah.
You know, if there is a counterfeiting ring out there, counterfeiting bearer bonds in the trillions of dollars and doing so over and over again, you know, it's one time I could buy maybe counterfeit, but doing it three different times and increasing the amount each time and making it more elaborate each time. Who spends that kind of money? It's off the charts. The narrative that they're trying to feed us makes no sense.
I think that's an excellent example of your work going deeper and opening up all kinds of other vistas with that one piece. It opens and plugs into the space program, political assassination, and a secret system operating, you know, right underneath the regular system, damn close.
It's operating in tandem with it because you can't make a system like that work without the participation of major prime banks. Just can't.
Interesting.
Do it.
Right. Yes. They have to be in on it.
They have to be in.
I guess we should have said also that the bearer bond windows, well, they closed them eventually. They were like, you know, we can't have everybody cashing these things in. Like, they couldn't have run on the secret bank, right?
The thing that they do now is if you run across one of these things and don't even try and cash it, but you turn it into the FBI or whoever, you know, Bank of England or whoever, they'll arrest you.
Right. They'll grab it and arrest you.
Yep.
Wow. Unbelievable.
Yeah. Why?
Excellent point.
You're turning over a piece of counterfeit paper to the authorities. What's the crime?
Wow. Yeah. Amazing. Joseph, fantastic. And we will
talk
soon,
sir. Yep. Bye-bye.
Great to see you.
Good to see you. You said you wanted to talk about something after we were done, or did we talk about it already?